Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMC ortho.
Well, welcome everybody to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us in the studio today for Medical Monday is Dr. Cliff Connery. He's the medical director for the Dyson Center for Cancer Care at Vassar Brothers Medical Center and medical practice director for HealthQuest Division of Thoracic Oncology. He's the only dedicated thoracic oncologist and surgeon between Albany and Westchester County. He specializes in treatment of esophageal cancers, mediastinal tumors, and many more things like myasthenia gravis. Dr. Connery earned his medical degree in Eastern Virginia Medical School. He completed his general surgery residency at SUNY Stony Brook and his residency in cardiothoracic surgery at the University of Rochester. He's also served 13 years as a major in the U.S. Army Reserve Medical Corps and was clinical professor of surgery at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. His surgical techniques involve the use of Da Vinci robotic system, video-assisted surgery, and complex thoracic resection and reconstruction. Dr. Connery, we are honored and we so thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Alan, for inviting me today, and I look forward to participating in the program and answering some questions from the audience.
Well, you're going to get a lot of questions. So basically, esophagus is one site that you deal with. Another is the lung, and something new in the way we're looking at lungs these days?
Well, absolutely. There's so many new things, and I think that's one of the real exciting things that are going on now in thoracic oncology. Lung cancer, as you may know, is the number one killer for both men and women, more so than the next three or four cancers combined.
Interesting.
And
that includes breast cancer for women.
Yeah, actually breast and colon and ovarian for women combined, and for men, colon and prostate. So it really is a significant problem, and it's about 160,000 people a year in this country who are lost due to lung cancer.
160,000, wow.
And that's a real challenge, because when you take a look at the number who get it, which is just maybe a little bit more than 200,000, when those numbers who are diagnosed with the disease and then subsequently succumb to it are near this, are about the same, that's the real challenge. So can we do something to find it at a earlier, more curable stage? Mm-hmm. And fortunately, that really has happened, and it's really coming together over the last couple of years. Lung cancer screening for those people deemed to be at risk has proven to be a lifesaver.
So how do you find them to screen them?
Yeah, so what you want to do is to find them when they don't have symptoms. So the way to find them is to try to identify a population that is at risk. And the way that we would define that would be somebody who has been a significant smoker of a pack, the equivalent of a pack a day for 30 years, who is age 55 or older, and still fit to undergo treatment. And so if those people, if they have a CT scan of the chest, a low-dose CT scan without dye injection, they can undergo an examination that can find tumors at a very much smaller, more treatable, curable stage.
In the old days, I remember when I was having my most paranoid thoughts about whatever I could get, I looked up lung cancer, and they said only 5% were surviving after 5 years. That's improved a little bit, hasn't it?
Yeah, a little bit, but not as much as we want. Right now, it's probably about 17%. Mm-hmm. But if you find it early, for example, somebody who has a cancer that is found during a screening program can have upwards of an 80% five-year survival.
And how do you do that? You cut out the tumor?
In general, you cut out the tumor. The reason that is that the ones that you're finding are usually small enough to be removed with surgery. Or for those people who aren't quite fit enough for surgery, there are some new advances in radiation treatments, for example. There's this new type of treatment called stereotactic radiosurgery, which can, using a very finely focused beam in just a few treatments, eradicate small tumors. So there are a lot of things that are coming together all at the same time in lung cancer treatment, between the screening, getting the word out about stopping smoking in the first place to try to prevent this from occurring, and then advances in diagnosis and staging.
So very quickly, why do people smoke?
Well, you know, people start it when they're younger. It may just be something to do with their friends. It becomes a social event. But the problem is, once you start it, it is a very addicting substance. And some people believe it's more addicting than some of the street drugs. Oh. And that's the real challenge for it. And it's a difficult thing to quit. Fortunately, now there are some more tools out there to help people quit. There's some smoking cessation medicines, some other therapy. There are some support groups. And even if you fail the first time, you should keep trying. That's the take-home message.
No question. Now, let me go very quickly, because we got phone calls to take, to the esophagus. It's another prime site. Smoking doesn't help the esophagus.
Correct. Doesn't help the esophagus. And it's, again, one of the challenges with the esophagus, you have that same sort of a relationship between the number of cancers identified and the lethality of the cancer. Much less, probably in the range of around 15,000 patients per year, but it is also a very lethal cancer if it's not found early. Fortunately now, we have more people who understand that one of the risk factors is Barrett's esophagus, and people who have that identified can be part of a surveillance program.
And there are a lot of us in the United States, aren't there?
Yeah, there's between 1 to 2 million people in the U.S. Mm. who have Barrett's. Well, the great majority of people with Barrett's will not develop esophageal cancer. It's those patients who have Barrett's that then have some inflammation and some what we call dysplasia that are a significantly increased risk.
And then when all of that is done and you find a candidate, how do you operate on the people with esophageal cancer?
Yeah, so like anything else, it really depends upon the stage. There are now some new tools that are available for people who have a very early identified tumor that is just within the lining of the esophagus. Sometimes that can just be actually removed with what they call endoesophageal ablation type therapies, or what submucosal resection, where using that small scope, they can look down the esophagus and actually remove that lining that has a superficial cancer. The people who have something that's a little bit deeper should probably have surgery for that. Anything deeper into the wall of the esophagus, or somebody who has some lymph nodes that are involved, they really need to undergo what's called multimodality therapy. And that's a theme that we're seeing across, where several types of disciplines, chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, will all come in at some point in combination to help treat a patient with malignancy.
And in your operation, you're in charge of all that.
Well, in the operation, correct. I guess so. One of the things that we do as being a thoracic surgical oncologist is to help develop the team that will help take care of each patient. Each patient is their own book. And what you need to do is to provide the resources that they will need to undergo effective treatment.
Well, Doctor, it's a great pleasure to have you here. So that we'll have more time on the other side, we'll take a brief break right now, and then we'll be right back for Jim and Lou and everybody else who's calling at 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing inpatient and outpatient health care in Schenectady and Southern Saratoga counties, ellismedicine.org. Lori Stilwell, CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond, stilwellcpa.com. Stewart Shops, we are closer to you, with milk from local farms. And Project Native, hosting their 5th Environmental Film Festival beginning Sunday with a full day of films at the Tower Theaters in South Hadley. ProjectNative.org.
And we are back. And it's terrific of you, Doctor, to be here with us. We very much appreciate it. Dr. Cliff Connery, Medical Director for the Dyson Center for Cancer Care at Vassar Brothers Medical Center. Okay, let's start taking calls. Number one. All right. Welcome back, Jim. How can I help you?
Supposedly mesothelioma is not transmitted by the ingestion of asbestos fibers. But what about the inhalation of aerosol microfibers when taking a shower? The microfibers coming from Agent Transite or asbestos cement water pipes in municipal systems?
Well, thank you, Jim, for this question. And in reality, you hit right on the crux of the issue. You know, mesothelioma, or otherwise known as malignant mesothelioma, is a disease of usually the lining of the chest wall, the lining of the lungs, and it's really one of those occupational hazards. It's been definitively shown to have been caused by asbestos exposure. Now, one of the challenges is that this small fiber is very ubiquitous. You know, we see it in many places. You know, the tradition has been those people who were involved in mining for asbestos and insulation. But when you think about all the other jobs, people who would, for example, back in the day when the brake shoes were made out of asbestos, or the body fillers in body shops. And what they did find is that there's a long latency from the time that you get exposed to this. You may not know you're being exposed to it. What they did indeed find also that people who dealt with the clothes of people who worked in the mines, so the spouses of employees in the mines, would actually get mesothelioma because they were secondarily exposed to the fibers. So it is a real challenge. Another thing about asbestos I should mention as well, too, is that the combination of smoking and asbestos is a significant additional risk factor for the development of lung cancer as well. So not just malignant mesothelioma, which is a very difficult tumor, but also it's a significant additional risk for those patients who have what would be called standard lung cancer.
Now, Jim just taught me something that I didn't know, which is, of course, a lot. But the idea that there are water pipes that are lined with asbestos, is that true?
I don't know about the internal.
Jim, is that what you said?
Yeah, it's called transite. They were pipes that they put in the water systems back in, probably in the 50s and 60s, maybe possibly before.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Jim, as always, thanks for your call. Appreciate it very
welcome.
Much.
Thank you, Jim.
That opens up one free phone. We'll go to Lou in Altamont. Okay, Lou, you're on.
Yes, population at risk. I'm a former Hodgkin survivor. 4,000 rats of cobalt radiation.
Right.
Don't know if you're familiar with that. And a full course of MOP chemotherapy. What should I be looking at in terms of a thoracic risk?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Lou. And that gets into the whole idea of survivorship now, which is something that we're starting to understand a little bit more and trying to train our teams to help work with people who have been treated for cancer. Because fortunately, when you look at globally, we are curing many people with cancer now. And so we should be looking at the effects of our treatments. So specifically for you, the main issue with Hodgkin's is that old radiation therapy and the development of possible in-field malignancies from the area where you had that cobalt radiation. That cobalt is a older style radiation, which, while effective, probably had a little bit more collateral damage than the current types of therapies. So usually you'll be looking for any lumps or bumps in your neck or in the middle of the chest. The question is whether or not there'd be any second issues as far as your thyroid is concerned. So those would be probably the more common ones that were in field with that radiation. I imagine it was probably in the middle of your chest, that irradiation that you had.
Yes. Would you be concerned with a hemangioma in the T78 area?
A hemangioma? Well, a hemangioma is a an abnormal group of blood vessels, and that's actually usually a benign growth. Now, you can get something which can be more aggressive, but these are, in general, that's a benign finding. So I don't know that I'd be concerned of that in particular.
Okay. Hey, Lou, we're going to let you go. We got a lot of people behind you, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lou. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We have two free phones. You want to get in on it? I would do it right now if I were you. We've got a Scott in Northampton. Okay, Scott, you're on.
I had a question. I'm 48 years old. I used to smoke less than half a pack of cigarettes a day. I quit back in 2004. My mom did pass away from lung cancer. I don't have any or any signs of cough or anything like that, but I thought, what's your suggestion for the most effective kind of, you know, screening for potential lung cancer, and how often should that be done?
Yeah, so going right to the current recommendations for screening would be those who are age 55 or older, who have smoked the equivalent of a 30-pack years, so more than you have smoked. But clearly, this is something which we don't catch everybody who has lung cancer with that type of a protocol, and we need to do more research in trying to identify other populations at risk. For example, more than 20% of women who have lung cancer have been never smokers. Now, sometimes that's related to secondhand smoke that maybe hasn't been quite accurately defined, but there are other risks, one of them being genetics. As you mentioned, that the concern of a family member, that is a little bit of a concern as well. Occupational exposures, we mentioned asbestos before earlier on in the program, other occupational exposures. So in your situation, the only thing that would probably be available would be a research trial, which would be looking at identifying better groups to be accurately screened for advantage. The challenge, if you try to screen everybody, is that you're going to find some little spots on the lungs which are not important and may cause some harm if you aggressively investigate some of these nodules. So you want to really focus your screening on at-risk populations.
But let's assume, Doc, that Scott decides, hey, I really want this done.
Right.
Because all the risk factors I've talked about, he can go to his doctor or they can do it for him, can't they?
Well, he can go to his doc and ask to be screened.
Sure.
One of the things, whether or not the insurance company would pay for it, that answer is no, most likely. But there are some roles to be entering into a trial. For example, we have a research arm on our screening trial, which looks at family history, looks at the smoking dose, and whether or not you have an occupational risk as well. And in addition, there is a blood test which may help us identify who is at increased risk for lung cancer. So if you put those things together, Scott, it may be that you would be eligible to enter into a research program for screening.
And if you went into the doc and said,
so if he was coughing, yeah, that's a different issue right
hey,
there.
Hey, Scott, thank
you. Would a basic doctor's visit, would a chest x-ray and a basic doctor's visit be helpful?
Well, when they looked from a population basis, if you did chest x-rays on a whole bunch of people, they didn't find that there was a survival advantage by getting a chest x-ray.
Interesting.
But in reality, if you get it by find something by serendipity, for that individual person, there's an advantage.
And how would the serendipity work?
Well, you know how the serendipity works? Is that, we see somebody who has a car accident,
yeah,
and they get a CAT scan.
Right, right, right.
And so all of a sudden, that CAT scan finds a little spot in the lung that wasn't identified beforehand. And so they didn't come in specifically for screening, but they had a finding which allowed us to identify something at a earlier, more treatable stage. So, Scott, what I would recommend is that maybe you take a look into the research program.
Thank you very much.
Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Freddie in Glens Falls. Oh, I think I did something wrong. Okay, Freddie, you're on. Freddie?
I want to talk about, I heard you talk about peer pressure and when people started to smoke. And my mother used to hide her carton of Camel cigarettes on the absurd cupboard in the kitchen till I learned to get on a stool. And all my friends and I started smoking at age 10. I'm 72, out behind the garage. And it became a thing to do. And David R. Schaefer is my oncologist at Albany Bend. And what I want to have people get in touch with is, when did you start to do this? It's a habit. It's much more than just the nicotine. It's smoke. When did you start to do this, and how can you start talking to yourself about how to not do it anymore? Because I had esophageal cancer. Alex Frank and Hillman and Lori Fuchs at Saratoga Radiation zapped me and whatever, and the cancer.
Okay, Freddie, only because there are so many people behind you, I wanted to give the doctor a chance to respond. Respond, because there wasn't a specific question, but
yeah.
Respond.
Well, I guess, Freddie, I think one of the things, and I was never a smoker, so I guess that's something I don't quite understand the whole process. But from what I understand for people who did smoke, one of the challenges is that you get into a habit. You, when you get that cup of coffee, you're used to getting a cigarette or certain types of social
exactly.
situations. And so,
exactly, it's a habit.
Yeah, and that's one of the challenges, is to try to get some support so or to develop some other coping mechanisms so that you don't reach for that cigarette.
People don't really grip that it's a habit, and they need to look at parts of their lives that made this habit happen and how to conquer it, instead of thinking carcinogens and cigarette and smoke and secondhand smoke. People have to get in touch with themselves.
Freddie, only because there are so many people behind you, I thank you for that insight. Doc, is there anything else you want to say about this?
I think that smoking, there is chemical addiction, but there are also some other behaviors that need to be addressed and get help for it. There's help out there.
If you can't swallow, go find a doctor.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Freddie.
Okay,
appreciate
Freddie.
It.
Bye-bye.
Okay, yeah, bye. Let's go to Dana in LaGrangeville. Dana, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Can you hear me?
Very well.
Okay, great. I have a 16-year-old son who, for at least a year now, has had what I would call an excessive throat clearing habit. I don't know that any time of day, it's just nonstop. That was the first thing. And then he recently had some blood, and I took him to an ENT over a year ago for this. They did a nasal endoscopy and didn't see anything and told me they didn't know what it was. Recently, he had some blood work, and I was told that his liver enzymes were quite high. His AST was 148, and his ALT, and none of this means anything to me, was 85. And I wondered if you had any idea what could be going on, if these two things could possibly be related, because I was told to see a GI person after we got those liver enzyme results.
Well, I think that the advice to go see a GI person was sound advice. Well, one of the things that can cause excessive throat clearing would be problems with sinuses, for example, and you saw an ENT. So people get a lot of mucus, which can drain down from the sinuses. It sort of sits in the back of your throat. Mm-hmm. You try to clear that a lot. Mm-hmm. One of the things that can cause sinus inflammation, though, is gastroesophageal reflux, where you have reflux of gastric content, stomach contents, up the esophagus, and at nighttime it can get up into the upper throat and can cause inflammation and irritation in that regard. And there are some younger folks who are actually challenged, with that. Now, is he if some kinds of medications can actually predispose you to this, and some types of medications can predispose to some inflammation in the liver. In and of itself, esophageal reflux shouldn't cause some liver abnormalities. But so I think by going to the gastroenterologist, you'll have somebody who can take a look at both sides of the picture, can take a look at the liver aspect, and also take a look to see whether or not there's any reflux that is contributing to this excessive throat clearing.
Okay. And did those numbers seem high to you as well?
Well, you know, there are different abnormal values depending upon the lab, but it seems like they are elevated. And so I think that they'll probably want to repeat the labs to see if it was something that was just sporadic. But if it's persistent, then they'll need to do some additional testing.
Dana, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at VoxPop at WAMC, VoxPop one word, at WAMC.org. Bonnie wants to know, having done it that way, what percent of cancer risk to adult children of two heavy smokers, 2.5 and 3.5 packs respectively? They died of emphysema before they got the cancer. Also, does in utero exposure raise later cancers too? And that's from Bonnie.
Well, those are good questions, Bonnie. I think that one of the challenges that we have with people who have secondhand smoke exposure is that family members also are sharing the genetics as well. So it may be hard to figure out exactly which one is contributing the most. But I would say that secondhand smoke plus family members who had significant smoking-related diseases would put you, we would think, at increased risk. So the the important thing.
What about the in utero question?
Yeah, I really don't know about the in utero piece myself. So that's something that I would have to learn a little bit about. But I don't know about any increased within utero.
Interesting. Yeah. Although I'm not a doctor, of course, I would say like reverse chicken soup, it couldn't help.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you worry about blood supply and stuff like that too as well, because of all the other things that smoking does to your blood pressure, your coronary artery disease, atherosclerosis, etc.
So we got one free phone, folks. Use it now. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Dana in LaGrangeville. All right, Dana, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Wow, that was quick. Hi, my name is Janice. And hi, Janice. Alan, thank you for always being there. And doctor, thank you so much for being there and taking my call. So I hope I can make sense. My dad died of cancer. His primary site was a colon cancer. They got it, totally took care of it, and a little while later, less than a year, they found it in the liver, so they called that the secondary site.
Right.
And I just have a geek kind of mind, and my curiosity is, are those cells that are now in the liver, do they look like, are they the size and shape or whatever the marker is of colon cells?
That is a great question, and that's one of the challenges that people usually have, is understanding that a metastatic tumor is really...
That's when it travels.
When it travels. Yeah. So, for example, a colon cancer that goes to the liver is really a colon cancer. It's not a liver cancer.
Interesting.
And the colon cancer, we in the chest actually tend to see this as well, because one of the places that colon cancer can spread to are the lungs as well. Colon and rectal cancer can both spread to the lungs, sometimes combined liver and lungs. So, yes, it is related to the colon itself. And as such, treatments that are effective against colon are usually effective. So the chemotherapy that they might recommend would be one that would work for colon cancer, even though it's in the liver, or other types of treatments, depending upon the extent of disease and the fitness. Sometimes they can actually remove that spread that goes to the liver, or treat it with very focused radiation or with radiofrequency ablation, depending upon the number and the actual location within the liver that tumor has spread to.
So when you're looking at the cells in the actual liver of the cancer, they look like the ones that were in the colon?
Exactly. That's how they come up with it. And in fact, now they have not just looking at it. You know, the old way to look at pathology was called light microscopy, where they would take a look with a microscope, put several types of stains on it, and say, this looks like colon cancer. Now they actually have it to the next level, where they can actually take a look at some of the proteins, genetic signatures, et cetera, so they can really differentiate where these tumors are coming from.
That's amazing.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Okay. And we're now going to go to Donna in Avril Park, where everybody's a Harriman. Go ahead, Donna.
I enjoy all of your broadcasts, Alan, and I always enjoy your questions. To the doctor, I'm glad you're there. I have Barrett's, and I had a polyp removed. I'm still waiting for the results on the polyp. What I'm interested in knowing is, what would be the characteristics or the symptoms if at some point that Barrett's is becoming a cancerous growth?
Well, the things that you would worry about with Barrett's would be problem swallowing. So if you notice, and this can be a little subtle, that you might have to chew your food a little bit more carefully for it to pass through, or you might have to wash it down with some liquids, or maybe avoid certain types of food. So that would be something where you're actually starting to get a growth in the esophagus that's taking up space and causing obstruction. Now, ideally, we would want to be able to find this before that happened, because as you may have heard at the very beginning, when you can find a tumor that's growing very early in the lining of the esophagus, it becomes much simpler to treat and also much more likely to be cured. So the best thing that you're doing, it sounds like you just had an endoscopy. Is that true, Donna, where they did the biopsy?
I had the endoscopy. We're waiting for the results of the biopsy. Right. What the doctor said is that if the biopsy comes back negative, that I'll go 3 years before my next endoscopy. So my concern is, over 3 years, a lot can happen, and what should I be looking at?
Yeah, so So that would be the symptoms that we just mentioned, pretty much, would be the swallowing difficulties. Now, in reality, with Barrett's disease, where there's no dysplasia, which means a change in the characteristics of those cells that line the esophagus that look a little bit more suspicious, if there's no dysplasia, the three-year recommendation is pretty effective. And so I think the likelihood that something would sneak up on you would be very low. And so that's would be the standard recommendation now. But of course, if you develop some swallowing issues, you should just seek attention.
So
thank you. That was very direct. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So let me ask you this. When we have acid reflux problems,
right,
often there's a hiatal hernia, you know, right, involved in that. There's a debate here in Albany among some of my physicians who say, one guy is a surgeon, and he says, I can fix this surgically, get rid of that hiatal hernia, I'll take care of it. And my physician says, absolutely not. You're not going to do that. Right. What's the answer on that one?
Well, it's a controversial issue, but the challenge with reflux are two. One is the heartburn that you get, so the discomfort that you get because you have acid,
yep,
which is going up into the esophagus. Well, they do have pretty effective pills for the acid.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
have sometimes been tied into osteoporosis.
Well, the other challenge, though, is that it takes care of the acid, but it doesn't stop the mechanical reflux. And so you can still get the stomach juices going up into the esophagus. Now, you can just think of acid as being very caustic and causing some pain, et cetera. But there are some other things which actually don't cause pain. Some people will reflux what's called bile, which has some of the enzymes and acids that are in the duodenum. People who reflux bile actually can have an increased risk of developing esophageal cancer, and they don't actually feel the pain. So that's one of the challenges, and maybe one of the reasons why we're seeing a higher incidence of esophageal cancer now because of reflux.
And should we? And so which side of that argument do you come down on, the pills versus the surgery?
Yeah, I think that the pills can control your symptoms. I think that if you have mechanical problems from the reflux, sinus problems, aspirations, one of the things, or asthma, some people will choke on some of their secretions at night and it'll cause some inflammation of the lung. I think if you have a mechanical problem, you should have anti-reflux surgery. I think that if you're having difficulty controlling your symptoms with medicines, you should look into anti-reflux surgery. Or if you have some dysplasia, now that's probably a role where if you start to get the inflammation in the lining of the esophagus, perhaps they could do an ablation procedure where they strip that abnormal mucosa out and then have an anti-reflux procedure to try to keep the reflux, the gastric juices, from going back up. What happens when they strip that abnormal mucosa, that lining, is that it repopulates with normal-looking cells.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay, we're going to be right back. We're going to take a second, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from the Stram Center Investigative Medicine, specializing in Lyme, women's health, gastrointestinal, cancer treatment, acupuncture, and nutrition, located 10 minutes from Albany and in Bennington, Vermont, stramcenter.com. Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years, qfcc.com. Friends of Chamber Music, presenting Calidor String Quartet, performing music of Ravel, Bartok, and Ne-Yo. Sunday, 3 p.m. at the Emma Willard School in Troy, friendsofchambermusic.org. Eagle Hill School, Hardwick, Massachusetts, a college prep boarding and day school for students with learning disabilities and ADD, featuring a 5-week summer session, ehs1.org for info.
And we are back. We are delighted to have you. It's been a great show so far. And we have Dr. Cliff Connery with us, Medical Director of the Dyson Center for Cancer Care at Vassar Brothers Medical Center, and Medical Director, Practice Director for HealthQuest's Division of Thoracic Oncology. Okay, we got an email at WAMC.org, voxpop at WAMC.org. Good afternoon, Doctor. We keep hearing about the connection between secondhand smoke and the development of lung cancer. But what about breathing and other types of smoke? I spend a lot of time driving around in traffic. Should I be worried about breathing in smoke from car and truck exhaust? What about the smoke of a fireplace or a barbecue grill?
Now, that's a great question. And I think in other parts of the world, some cultures, people do a lot of their cooking or heating in the house with maybe coal stoves. And there has been, to my understanding, a significant increase in the incidence of lung cancer in some of these societies for the women who are actually in the house and cooking using those types of equipment. We do worry about diesel fumes and some of the other noxious smokes. It's kind of hard to know exactly how to quantify the exposure and what the real risk is. But I think, like anything else, some of these things, you want to try to avoid it if at all possible.
Yep. Thank you for that. Let's go to Greg in, we'll see where Greg is. Okay, Greg, you're on.
Yeah, I just been going through six treatments of R-CHOP for the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And what I'm told is that I'm in remission, cancer-free, but that I have a tumor, something called a Wharton's tumor. Can you tell me anything about that?
Yeah, the Wharton's tumor is usually a benign tumor in the parotid gland, which is actually a gland that's on the side of your face behind the ear. And so it's one of your major glands in the face, and that can be the site for developing some tumors. And this is, in general, a benign tumor. These things can enlarge, cause some local problems, et cetera. I think that it's something that you would want a head and neck surgeon to take a look at, and so that they can talk to you about the risks and benefits of having it treated.
Well, Greg, obviously you've done some of that. What do they say?
Well, I'm going to go to ear, nose, and throat. No one said to go to head and neck. But I'm just concerned because I'm getting a sensation in my jaw that I had at the very beginning of all of this. And I thought that this was part of the lymphoma. This is where it was all originating, in my neck, as you probably know.
Right.
And it had been blown up. My whole side, that side of my face was really blown up quite a bit. And so I'm still concerned. I feel something's going on. And when I do my rebounding in the house on the trampoline, which I was doing before this and now started doing it again now that I'm all through with the chemo, I'm finding both I had to stop before the chemo because when I would rebound, something in my head was like, you know, in my ear or near my ear and in my head, like, would be popping. And it was very uncomfortable.
Okay, so Greg, let's get Doc, give him a chance because there's a lot of people lined up behind you. Go ahead.
Yeah, so again, this tumor, which is in the parotid gland, there are certain nerves which run across your face that go through that gland. And so it's possible that, if depending upon the size of the growth and where it's located within the gland, that it could be giving you some symptoms in that area. And when I said head and neck surgeon, that's really just another way of saying ear, nose, and throat, or otolaryngologist. They're kind of similar descriptions of that same specialty.
Greg, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. All right, let's go to Kathy, who's on the Mass Pike. I hope you've got hands free. Go ahead, Kathy.
Yes, I do. My husband was diagnosed 2.5 years ago with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and I understand there's some type of a correlation between that and lung cancer, and I was just wondering if the doctor could talk about that generally.
Now, just let's get this straight. Idiopathic, Doc, means we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know, and pulmonary fibrosis means scarring in the lungs, and it can be a challenging problem.
There are it's what Robert J. Lerzimer, our great classical music guy, died of.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, there are certain types of inflammatory processes, which many of them are immune system related, where somehow the immune system gets turned on. They don't know exactly why, and it looks at your own body as the invader. And so your immune system becomes hyperactive and it starts to attack certain types of structures, and the lungs are actually the target for some of these. Some of them are treatable by treating with steroids to sort of turn the immune system off. They have some side effects, et cetera. So that's one of the things that can happen. The pulmonary fibrosis can give you problems with breathing, shortness of breath, because the lungs become so stiff and thick that they don't exchange the gases effectively. One of the things, when you think of something that's inflamed and irritated, you can also have a higher incidence of cancer in damaged areas of lung. And so we have seen some data which looks like there's a correlation between fibrosis and outcomes when patients have cancers. and it's kind of hard to sort out exactly how much of it is because the lungs are in such bad shape and that's impacting survival, or is it actually the fibrosis itself causing the cancer to behave less favorably?
So, Kathy, has your husband received steroids?
No, he hasn't yet. He's declining. But he's still fairly stable. But I know he's getting regular HRCT, and so I'm assuming that if there was anything coming up with lung cancer, they would probably catch that fairly quickly with the CTs he's having.
Yeah, and I think that's the best test that we have for this, and it becomes a challenge sometimes trying to look at the scans themselves and to interpret it because there's so much inflammation and damage. But I think one of the reasons to do it is that we do have methods to treat a cancer in somebody who has some medical issues that does not involve surgery. So we have now more minimally invasive techniques where perhaps if it's something that's very localized, we can just remove that small portion of the lung and try not to disturb his function as much. Or in somebody who is not fit enough for that, we can use other modalities such as that stereotactic radiation that I spoke of earlier, that very precise radiation. So we are able to treat people who have more advanced age and who have more advanced medical problems over this new time frame here now, this new relatively exciting time here for lung cancer treatment.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for your call, and good luck, okay?
Thank you.
Okay,
thank
bye-bye.
You very much.
Yeah. Let's go to Lisa in Warwick. Okay, Lisa, you're on.
Yes, I just wanted the doctor to expand on a situation that I went through, hopefully to keep someone else from going through the same scare. I actually had an MRI done, and they found, for something else, and they found spots on my lung. And they said, well, you know, go to, you know, the lung specialist, and they'll further help you with that. And I was terrified because I was exposed to a lot of secondhand smoke growing up. I went, I had a chest x-ray, he looked at it, he said, you know, this is something we see typical, with, and you could see on the x-ray, they're calcified spots, so it's like a scarring spot where you've had, like, some kind of, probably a fungus, because people in the Midwest pick this up, and it's typical, so it wasn't a cancer. But he said it's very common that they see this in lungs a lot of the time. So I just wondered if you'd expand on that and, you know, possibly help someone else.
Okay, Doc, we don't have a lot of time, but maybe you could just do something briefly.
Yes, so...
And I'll hang up.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Go ahead.
Okay, Doc. So... when you're taking a look at a spot in the lungs, there are certain types of characteristics that might give us an idea as to whether or not it's benign or malignant. The spot that you mentioned before, there are certain areas in this country where you can be exposed to certain types of fungi and organisms that can give you spots in the lung that might look like a cancer, but in reality might just be a benign growth. So how do we do it? The most important thing with these is to not freak out with the first scan, is to go ahead and repeat the imaging. That's usually the proper answer. And on subsequent imaging, if you want to call it time-lapse photography, if there's some growth, then we can identify an area that should be biopsied. Not everything that grows will be a cancer, but the usual second step is repeat imaging after a period of time. And that's for our regular lung screening programs as well.
Lisa, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
We'll go to Jim in Malta. Okay, Jim, real quickly, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I'm calling about my son who lives in China, and he recently, he's had acid reflux for quite a while, and it got worse, and he had some nausea and stomach discomfort. So he had a scope, and they diagnosed him with GERD, and he has to return actually after Chinese New Year's for a follow-up because they removed the small tumor from his lower esophagus. Hmm. And they have him on, again, Nexium.
Sure.
And also a medication called mesoprolide citrate.
Yeah, I'm not sure of that one, per se.
I'm just wondering.
But we all know about Nexium, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think that the main treatments for GERD would be to suppress the acid secretion. So there are certain medications like Nexium that will do that, which will reduce the amount of acid that is produced. The other thing,
small tumor on his lower esophagus.
Yeah, so it depends upon what that was, and so if it was benign polyp. So really you need to get that pathology report translated for you and sent home with him so that he has that data here for the folks who are going to be taking care of him here.
Well, he lives over in China. So.
Oh, okay. All right. So I think that depending upon the pathology if there was something that was dysplasia, they're going to want to repeat the scope at a much shorter interval. But I think it's not just the meds to reduce the acid. There are certain other things that you need to do to try to reduce the reflux, the mechanical bathing of the esophagus with that stomach juice. So avoiding caffeinated products, eating smaller meals, sitting upright when you eat, don't lie flat immediately after you eat. Try to do some of these mechanical things. And I guess one of the challenges here for many of the folks in this country is that many folks will have a burden of extra fat, let's say. So try to lose some weight, and that can be something.
Really just they told them after the procedure that the polyp was benign, but they can tell that before a biopsy?
They can tell it afterwards. They can have a suspicion when they're taking a look at it, but it's actually truly under the microscope that they can say whether or not it's benign or malignant, and they can also put it in the context of what else they saw, that lining of the esophagus, when they looked in with the scope.
Well, Jim from Malta, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right, let's go to Mike in Hatfield. Okay, Mike, you're on.
Hi, quick question. I quit smoking 2 weeks ago. And my doctor told me that your lungs, your heart will forgive you, but your lungs won't. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't exactly agree with that. But the point is, from the second you stop smoking, from that very first puff, your heart got better. That very first not puff. So from that very second, your heart got better because it's that constriction effect on the blood supply was improved. Now, the lungs, it's going to take a little bit more time. There still is an increased risk of cancer over time, but the data shows that it's never too late to quit. This is actually pretty pertinent because just a couple of weeks ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, there was a study which showed that there's a significant number of additional diseases that are now believed to be related to smoking. There were five more categories of disease, and they think now that there's been an underestimate in this country as to how many people suffer death due to smoking-related causes. Right now, it's estimated with that new study up to 540,000 people a year die due to smoking-related causes.
Hey, Mike from Hatfield, well, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to very quickly to Cheryl from Troy. Okay, Cheryl, it's got to be fast. Go ahead.
You were talking about hiatal hernias. I had one in GERD 2010. I had a Nissen fundoplication. Thought that I would not have reflux after that, but I seem to have gotten it again. Is that common?
I wouldn't say that it's common, but it can happen. There is an incidence of repeat hernia or failed surgery. Now, there is also the fact that when you're doing the anti-reflux surgery, you don't necessarily want to make the wrap as tight as possible because then some people, can't belch, and they get gas bloat. And so that means that you can still have some reflux. So on balance, what you would hope is that the real important reflux and the number of times a day that stomach juice is going up into the esophagus is significantly reduced. Now, what can you do if you have had prior surgery and have some reflux? Well, some of those measures that I just spoke about, before can help you. And then some people need to be on medicine as well, too.
Yeah, Nexium seems to be helping a bit.
Yeah.
I bet so. Hey, thank you, Cheryl. Appreciate it.
Sure, Cheryl.
Okay.
Thanks.
Very, 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 very quickly. Teresa, we only got a second or
yes,
two.
Yes, thank you. My question's on myasthenia gravis. My father was diagnosed with this and had a feeding tube. And my question is this a genetic or hereditary?
We don't know that it's actually hereditary. It can be related to tumors in the thymus gland or to some abnormalities in the thymus gland, some hyperplasia. But we don't, to my understanding, know that this is specifically a hereditary process.
Okay, Teresa, thank you very much.
Appreciate
it. Right?
Bye.
Well, we got them all. We're just about out of time. Thank you very much, everybody. I want to thank Dr. Cliff Connery. You are terrific, Cliff. Really terrific.
I really enjoyed speaking with the audience today and with you here as well today. Thank you so much, Alan.
So, Cliff Connery, we appreciate that. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phone. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Again, thanks for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/VoxPop. Stay tuned now for a news update.